Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story is the podcast helping you make sense of the news. Join me, Katya Adler, every weekday as I take a closer look at the stories making the headlines with insights from the BBC's global network of experts. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 6th of December, these are our main stories. Israeli forces have penetrated deep into the main city in southern Gaza. Journalists in Khan Yunis say the ground has been shaking because of the intensity of the bombardment. Vladimir Putin makes a rare trip abroad, but to countries where he is unlikely to be arrested. Former Prime Minister Boris Johnson says sorry to the UK COVID inquiry.
Can I just say how glad I am to be at this inquiry and how sorry I am for the pain and the loss and the suffering.
Also in this podcast, the only family to escape from North Korea this year.
We put the children to sleep with sleeping pills. I knew my entire family could be executed if I made one mistake.
And why the Czech police are saying thank you to the vandals behind the spray painting of a train. We begin in Gaza, where the Israeli military bombardment and ground offensive is continuing in the southern city of Khan Yunis and several other areas in the north of the Strip, where it believes senior Hamas leaders are living. People in Khan Yunis, hundreds of thousands of them who were forced to flee northern Gaza earlier in the war, are being ordered by Israel to evacuate the city and head towards Rafah. It's on the border with Egypt and the nearby Al-Mawasi area of the coast. Ghada is a Palestinian journalist who is living in Khan Yunis. She told the BBC about conditions where she is near the Nasser hospital.
The situation is so horrible, like airstrikes every minute maybe, and tanks. You cannot know where it will target. So we are living inside a dangerous situation, risky situation. We cannot move too much. People are trying to flee to Rafah, which is near to Khan Yunis city.
The UN's human rights chief says Palestinians are living in utter deepening horror. Volker Turk was speaking in Geneva, where he told journalists that in the conflict in Gaza, there was a heightened risk of atrocity crimes. Mr. Turk said there was a growing risk of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity.
The catastrophic situation we see unfolding in the Gaza Strip was entirely foreseeable and preventable. My humanitarian colleagues have described the situation as apocalyptic. Measures need to be taken urgently, both by the parties concerned and by all states, particularly those with influence, to prevent any such crimes. The international community needs to insist with one voice on a ceasefire immediately.
From Jerusalem, our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell told us more about the extent of the fighting.
There are these really fierce battles that are still going on between Israeli troops and Hamas fighters in strongholds of Hamas across the Gaza Strip. So in the north, you have Jabalia, also in the east of Gaza City, Shejaiya. And then, of course, the south of the Gaza Strip, the main focus is on Khan Yunis, the biggest city there, where Israel's military says it's now reached the heart of that city. It's the place where the Hamas leader of Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, and his brother are from. It's really a place where Israel suspects that Hamas leaders may be hiding in underground tunnels. But then, as well as all of this, we have got the heaviest bombing that's been seen in one of the most intense phases of the war so far. And that has really been pushing up the civilian death toll in the past few days.
And reports that the Israeli military has found a huge stockpile of weapons in the northern Gaza Strip.
Yes, yeah, so it's put out a video that shows what it says is a massive weapons depot, one of the largest it's found, that was close, it says, to a clinic and a school, and it consists of hundreds of rockets and rocket launchers, including long-range rockets, it says, drones as well, ready to use explosive devices. And we are told that in the current stage of the war, Hamas fighters have been using a lot of improvised explosive devices and mines as they target Israeli forces. So these weapons have all been seized by the Israeli soldiers. They say some have been destroyed and some have been sent for further investigation.
And terrible pictures coming out of hospitals in Gaza.
Yes, once again, hospitals are really being overwhelmed, particularly in Khan Yunis. We're getting pictures from the Nasser hospital there that show people who have been treated on the floor of the hospital. They just don't have enough space to deal with the dozens of casualties that get rushed in by all means at one time. Also, some very disturbing pictures from near to the Al-Aqsa hospital, which is in the centre of the Gaza Strip. We were shown some footage of a mass grave that was being dug there. People weren't being able to get a decent burial. Space has actually run out in the local cemetery, the grave digger was saying, and it was seen as a necessity to bury all of the bodies that have been accumulating in the hospital there in Deir al-Balah, where there has been very intense bombardment. And the pictures we could see of people being buried, we were told all of them were people who'd been displaced, who'd come from locations in the north. They'd come south to Deir al-Balah seeking safety.
Yoland Nell. Israeli police have launched investigations into rape and sexual assault by Hamas attackers on the 7th of October, as you may have heard on the Global News podcast. Finding out exactly what happened has been complicated by limited forensic data and few known surviving victims. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has been looking at the evidence and speaking to some of those involved. A warning that you will hear some graphic and disturbing testimony.
This is the first time that we've been allowed inside this site. It's really eerie being here.
We first visited the festival site just days after the attacks. The ground strewn with clothes and bedding. Cars left with their doors wrenched open. Chaos and panic frozen onto the site. Since then, stories have begun to emerge about the rape and sexual assault of women by Hamas fighters, including one graphic eyewitness account filmed by police investigators and shown to journalists.
They bent her over, and I realised they were raping her, one by one. Then she was passed to another man in uniform. She was still alive when she was being raped. He shot her in the head while he was still raping her. They cut off her breast and played with it on the street.
Police have opened investigations into sexual assault and rape. Yaakov Shabtai is Israel's chief of police.
It's not one-off. We have another testimony of women. You understand that those guys came to do something. It's not a rape. It's to insult the human being from the other side. It's something that I'm sorry. It's hard to me even to speak about it. Allah, Allah!
Footage shot by Hamas during the attacks appears to show a large bloodstain on the trousers of one woman captive. Photos and testimony from the body collectors describe women lying with their legs splayed, naked from the waist down, often mutilated or burnt. Investigators say they're trawling through 60,000 hours of video footage and 1,000 testimonies, but they admit there's a lack of forensic evidence from the sites.
First 5 days, we still had terrorists on our ground in Israel. And there were hundreds of bodies everywhere. You couldn't identify who is who. They were burned, they were without organs, they were butchered completely.
May Golan is Israel's Minister for Women's Empowerment. She told me that very few victims of rape had survived, and that witnesses were also struggling with what they saw.
I spoke with at least 3 girls that are now hospitalized for a very hard psychiatric situation because of the rapes they watched. They pretended to be dead and they watched it and they heard everything from the side and they can't deal with it.
Crucial evidence has come from staff at the Shura military base where bodies were brought for identification. The sound of the refrigerated containers used as a makeshift morgue droning hour after hour around the clock. I asked Captain Mayan, a dentist working as a reservist soldier with the forensics team, what proportion of women she thought had been sexually attacked.
It's definitely multiple. It's hard to tell. I've also dealt with more than a few burnt bodies, and those, I have no idea what they went through beforehand. Bodies that are missing the bottom half, I also don't know what they, if they were raped. But women that were clearly raped,
Back at the Army Identification Unit, one worker told me there were patterns in the violence she'd seen, mapped by location. Investigators say these attacks were systematic and premeditated, but piecing together even one single story is slow and difficult work. The wider story of sexual violence as a part of these attacks is only just beginning.
Lucy Williamson. Vladimir Putin doesn't go abroad much these days. The Russian leader's reluctance to travel has only deepened since the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for him on suspicion of the illegal deportation of Ukrainian children, which is a war crime. However, today, President Putin has been in the United Arab Emirates before then moving on to Saudi Arabia. So why has the Russian leader decided to venture further afield? I asked our correspondent Samir Hashmi, who is also in the UAE covering the COP28 UN climate summit.
I think there are multiple reasons for that. The first key reason is that if you look at President Putin over the last few years, he has pushed for closing ties, to have closer ties with the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The last time he came to the UAE was in 2019, and this is the first trip he's making in 4 years. The second thing is that there are a lot of areas where all these countries have been working together. For example, oil production globally. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Russia, they all are part of OPEC Plus and have been jointly taking decisions when it comes to oil production and the cuts they've made in order to prop up prices. The second thing is that President Putin is also using this trip as an opportunity to position Russia, to show basically that Russia still has influence in the Middle East region. Because if you look traditionally, even in the Israel-Palestine conflict, Russia has been part of the group along with the US and EU that has worked towards finding a solution. And now this, the war in Gaza gives him an opportunity to basically re-enter geopolitics and try to show his influence in the region, which is why he's meeting not only the UAE presidentship, but also going to meet Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who's the de facto ruler. And tomorrow, he flies back to Moscow today, and tomorrow he's hosting Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi in Moscow. So he'll be meeting three close allies from the Persian Gulf in a span of 48 hours.
And no chance he will be arrested?
Definitely no chance for that, because the ICC, which is the International Criminal Court, which issued the arrest warrant against President Putin, Saudi Arabia and the UAE both are not, they haven't signed the founding treaty. So there is no obligation for them to arrest him or detain him, and which is why I think President Putin also felt very confident to make this trip. Remember, this is a rare trip, as you said, because he's been, since the war started, he's just been to the former states which were associated with the Soviet Union, and he visited China in October. So this is definitely a significant trip from that point of view.
Samir Hashmi. Britain's former Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been explaining himself to the country's COVID inquiry. He's talked starkly about his strategy of driving Britain's response to the pandemic, defended missing key coronavirus meetings in the first weeks of 2020, and admitted footage of victims from a COVID wave in Italy rattled him. He began a little after 10 o'clock in the morning UK time, and as soon as he started speaking, he was interrupted by a protest in the room.
Can I just say how glad I am to be at this inquiry and how sorry I am for the pain and the loss and the suffering.
Sit down. Please stop.
COVID
stop.
Victims.
Please sit down. Please sit down, or I'm afraid you'll have to leave the hearing room. I'm sorry, if you don't sit down, I'm going to ask the ushers to get you to leave. Right, could you ask them to leave?
Mr. Johnson was at the helm as the pandemic took hold and has been sharply criticised for his decision-making, or lack of it, previously, by experts, scientists and fellow ministers. He told the inquiry that in the build-up to lockdown in March 2020, he couldn't grasp how big the pandemic would become.
In that period, January really to the end of February, towards the end of February, COVID was pretty much like a cloud on the horizon, no bigger than a man's hand. And you didn't know whether it was going to turn into a typhoon or not.
Our political correspondent Rob Watson is following events.
I'm glad you played that last bit of Boris Johnson, because that really goes to the sort of heart of his defence. To sort of sum it up, essentially two accusations have been put to him. One is that you've just really been hearing there, which is, how come, given the evidence in January and February of 2020, how come you, Mr Johnson, and your government, a sophisticated government like the UK, couldn't see what was coming? And you heard his defence there, which was, you know, it's a kind of a failure of the imagination. We thought it might be like SARS. We thought it might be like flu. We just didn't see that. So that's the nub of his defence. And the other thing that that we heard, the second allegation, was about him, that you are sort of indecisive, that all your inner circle, we've heard testimony of how poisonous, dysfunctional it was inside your government. You were described as running a toxic regime. And his response to that, his defence was kind of interesting, saying, look, you know, I'm sure that happened in other governments, and it was just a reflection of how frazzled the entire country and government was in dealing with such an enormous challenge.
There was a sort of apology.
Well, sort of. I'm glad you put it that way, Alex. I don't think it was really in the sense that, yes, he said he was sorry for the pain, for those who'd lost their lives. But absolutely, kind of critically, he has been defiant. I mean, defiant in a demure way, Alex, but defiant in the sense of his two arguments are, look, you know, we did the best that we could with what we knew at the time to defend lives and to defend the health system. In hindsight, yes, we could have done things better. But at the time, I think we did the best we could. And then, of course, that sort of defence of what others have said is his utterly dysfunctional government, saying, hey, you know, it's just a product of the tense times we were living in.
Are the families of the COVID bereaved going to be satisfied?
No, I'm pretty sure that the public reaction to this is going to be from COVID families and others who've taken the view that Boris Johnson is untrustworthy, incompetent and basically just not a very pleasant character. I suspect that none of this will change their view. And also that sort of large chunk, that large minority who tend to take the view of Boris as good old Boris, he probably did as best as he could, I suspect that they won't change their view either. The really interesting thing, Alex, for this country and for the rest of the world will be, what recommendations will the inquiry make as to how a big, sophisticated country like the UK could do better next time?
Rob Watson. Coming up in the Global News podcast, alone without being lonely, we hear how solitude affects us.
There isn't a sort of one-size-fits-all, you know, this is what works and what doesn't. But actually, we each can think about what solitude offers as an opportunity to us.
With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
I believe in the curse. Yeah, I think it's real.
Is it just superstition? Or could there be more to it?
Sometimes I think there's something sinister going on.
What do we need to do to win an All-Ireland final for Mayo?
Listen to the curious tale of the Mayo Curse on Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
A North Korean who managed to flee the country by sea with his entire family has told the BBC there has been a great deal of suffering since the country sealed its borders at the start of the pandemic. Since then, defections, which were once common, have almost ceased. This family is the first to have escaped this year and made it to the south. Mr. Kim spoke exclusively to our correspondent in Seoul, Gene McKenzie. He has asked us not to use his full name to help protect his family in Seoul and back in North Korea.
This was a remarkable escape. Firstly, because North Korea over the past few years has made it almost impossible to leave. And secondly, because of how this family escaped. Almost everyone who escapes North Korea comes across the border into China. But this family lived right down in the south of the country. And so they left on a small fishing boat. There were two brothers, their wives, their mother, some children and in-laws. And it was the older brother who was the mastermind. He'd been planning this meticulously for months. And this is who I met in Seoul. And he talked me through their plan in detail, particularly the night of the escape. They had moored their boat on a remote part of the coast. And to get here, they had to walk through an area with landmines with his brother's small children. Here's Mr. Kim talking about that moment, though it's not his voice. We've changed it to protect him.
We put the children to sleep with sleeping pills and hid them in grain sacks that we disguised to look like bags of tools. I was almost paralyzed by fear. The boat was very loud, but all I could hear was my heartbeat. I knew my entire family could be executed if I made one mistake.
But they made it. They were able to cross into South Korean waters undetected and were rescued by the Navy here. Mr. Kim told me that since the borders closed, there had been a lot of suffering, that everybody's life had become much harder because for a long time the authorities stopped food coming into the country and so prices skyrocketed, he said. The situation really deteriorated, he noticed, in the spring of last year. And then this year, two people he knew starved to death. They were farmers. And farmers in his area, he said, had the hardest time. They were the ones that were running out of food. He then said the pandemic restrictions on top of this made life more desperate.
When there were cases of COVID, everyone would be locked up and the entire area sealed off. The people inside had little or nothing to eat. After they had starved for a while, the government would bring in truckloads of supplies to sell, so people would praise them. It's like starving your baby, then giving it a small amount so it would thank you. People started asking whether this was the state's plan to profit from the pandemic.
It's important to point out that this is just one person's experience, and it's difficult to extrapolate what's happening across the country. It does seem, though, that the situation has deteriorated in this area to the point where some people are starving. But the NGOs I've been speaking to say the numbers still seem small and it's not as serious as during the famine of the 1990s. Mr. Kim also talked a lot about the government becoming more controlling, people being punished for a whole range of activities, but particularly for watching foreign films and music, especially content from South Korea. This regime we know feels threatened by this content. Mr. Kim told me it had introduced new crackdown squads to try and root out people watching it.
People started calling the crackdown officials mosquitoes, like vampires sucking out our blood. They're ruthless. They'll shoot you, kill you, or send you to a labor camp. Last year, they publicly executed a 22-year-old man for listening to South Korean songs and sharing them with his friends. They said they were punishing him harshly to set the right precedent.
We can't verify this execution, but we do know that North Korea introduced a new law that says people can be executed for sharing South Korean content. What struck me about meeting Mr. Kim is what an unusual case he is. He was not suffering in North Korea. He, it seems, was a very savvy businessman. He'd outsmarted the system and made a lot of money. And that's really why he was able to pull off this escape. At one point, he said to me, almost in disbelief, that everything had gone exactly according to plan. He said it was like the heavens helped us. And I think this shows now what it takes to escape North Korea. Vast amounts of money, meticulous planning, and an element of good luck. We only know about this story because Mr. Kim was successful. There are no doubt more who have tried to get out over the past few years and failed. And this is why we know so little about what's happening in the country and why this testimony is so important.
Gene McKenzie in Seoul. Tensions are rising in the South American country of Guyana over the future of a 160,000 square kilometre area of jungle. Crucially, it's rich in oil. And although Guyana has controlled the region of Essequibo for more than a century, following a referendum on Sunday, the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, has ordered his state oil company to issue extraction licences. The Guyanan president, Irfan Ali, has responded by putting the military on high alert and says he will ask the UN Security Council to intervene. He condemned his neighbour's actions.
This is a direct threat to Guyana's territorial integrity, sovereignty and political independence. The measures announced are in blatant disregard of the order given by the International Court of Justice.
With the background, here's our South America correspondent, Will Grant.
No sooner than the votes from Sunday's referendum were tallied, President Maduro has taken the next step in Venezuela's rapidly escalating territorial conflict with its neighbour Guyana. The Venezuelan leader has told the state-owned energy company PDVSA to begin issuing extraction licences for oil, gas and minerals in the disputed territory called Essequibo. Furthermore, a bill will be put before the National Assembly, controlled by his party, to turn the region into a new Venezuelan state called Guyana Essequiba. The steps come just 2 days after the non-binding vote in Venezuela over the sovereignty of Essequibo, an oil-rich and jungled region of around 160,000 square kilometres. The Venezuelan government claims around 10 million voters turned out on Sunday and that around 95% of them supported the steps exerting Venezuela's claim over the territory. Critics, however, say turnout was far lower and have dismissed President Maduro's focus on Essequibo as nationalistic saber-rattling ahead of next year's presidential election. Tensions are rising in Guyana, particularly following these latest steps. The Venezuelan defense minister has said that the issue should be resolved without military involvement for now. However, Mr. Maduro also ordered the creation of what he called an integral defense zone near the border with the disputed area, and some observers fear further militarization of the region.
Will Grant. When you think about being alone, do you smile with relief or despair? Was the poet William Wordsworth right to describe the bliss of solitude? Or the statesman and philosopher Francis Bacon, who wrote that anyone who is delighted in solitude is either a wild beast or a god. A new study tries to shed light on the complex relationship between time spent alone and mental health. Its author is Netta Weinstein, Professor of Clinical and Social Psychology at the University of Reading here in the UK. She's been speaking to Nick Robinson about being alone without being lonely.
Yeah, so what we wanted to do was get a snapshot of people's days when they spend a lot of time alone. And what we found was a little surprising, which is that it had both its costs and its benefits. So it was both good for a day, made for a good day, and made for not such a good day. But the results were a little more complicated. So days when we spent lots of time alone, we felt more relaxed, less stressed, like we could be who we are and have for ourselves time. We also felt more lonely, though.
So what's the key then if we're to get the benefits of being alone without the disbenefits of being lonely?
Yeah, so I think one of the really interesting things was, although we found both these costs and benefits, we always got the costs. It doesn't matter what reason we had for being alone. The more time we spent alone, the more relaxed we were and the more we felt we could just be ourselves. On the other hand, when we looked at loneliness, what we found is those people who really wanted to be alone, who chose that time for themselves, who saw value in it, they didn't feel as lonely. They didn't feel that they were less satisfied. They also had a pretty good day.
Do people have to discover how to be alone? Many people during lockdown were forced to be alone, and it took time, didn't it, for them? I mean, sometimes they never did find a way through it, but took time for people to discover how it was to use that time in a way that they found satisfying.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, when you think about lockdowns, we were all sort of forced to be alone. So in terms of choosing it, we weren't there because we had a choice. On the other hand, some people really enjoyed solitude in lockdown. And I think that was one of the surprising things to all of us researchers is, you know, for some people, they thought, great, I can learn a new skill. I can bake. I have more downtime. I can think through things. So, you know, we each have our own relationship with solitude. And I think that's one finding of the study is that there isn't a sort of one size fits all, you know, this is what works and what doesn't. But actually, we each can think about what solitude offers as an opportunity to us. And for some of us, it's not going to be a comfortable relationship. And it might be that brief periods of time alone are better and happier than long periods.
Professor Netta Weinstein, Professor of Clinical and Social Psychology. Finally, to a rather unusual criminal case in the Czech Republic, where police have thanked vandals for leaving their video camera running at the scene. Officers in Prague have urged the pair of graffiti sprayers to come forward, pointing out that they have already revealed their identities in high-definition footage. From Prague, Rob Cameron reports.
Sardonic humour is usually lacking in statements from the Czech police, but whoever wrote this one clearly enjoyed doing so. Officers from Prague's Masaryk station would very much like to speak to the two men, it read. First, to thank them for the very high-quality footage, and second, to charge them with a crime. The video shows the pair spraying a 7-metre slogan on what appears to be a new passenger train in broad daylight. They're then disturbed by a railway employee before sprinting away, leaving their camera running on the ground. They face up to a year in prison if, or perhaps when, they're convicted.
Rob Cameron. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Lovelock, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.